Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. Disrespect Today talks to Jason Wallace, the father of Kaylee Vitelli, on an update on Kaylee Vitelli's status and his feelings since he was published on the front page of the National Post July 3, 2010, about the article on Kaylee Vitelli.
In part, I think he was trying to reflect the reason things happened the way they did with that, but, you know, with the background of myself.
Okay.
So it wasn't, it didn't turn out positive, though. Kind of spit back in his face, as you would say. So
it went? Bit him back.
It kind of spit back in his face. It kind of didn't work, so
yeah.
It kind of ended up in a bad situation. So.
Well, it was publicity for Kaylee, which was a good thing, because that's a warning to anyone who would generate bad publicity about Kaylee, but that's about all it was.
Certainly.
It didn't address the issue.
No, it did not address the issue. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So...
How do you feel?
At the end of the day, we expect that with the media, and
okay.
You know, it is what it is, and you know, no offense to you guys, but you know,
Well, I'm unpaid. I'm media with a small M. So I do this because they do that.
Right, and I understand that.
Yeah.
I think the best way to kind of sum it up is to say that you know, the stories tend in our society to be turned into things that they're not, for reasons to sell money. I mean, to make money.
Yeah.
An article isn't going to sell if it's the same repetitive thing over and over again about, you know, the baby's sickness. They have to add something to it, so they spin it off, and that sells their papers for them. So
I think you're being kind to them. I think if they really dealt with the real issue, people would be outraged.
Well, I agree with that as well.
and there would be interest, and there would be discussion, and there would be change, and then the paper would be front and center as an agent of change and an accurate reporter of facts and within the context of real issues.
Well, I think so as well, and I don't, you know, don't get me wrong, I don't give you know, Joseph Breen any kind of pass for what happened here. I mean, I will be dealing with that through other methods, you know, but
Well, it was publicity. You can't argue with that, because a number of the other papers just hunched down and hid their heads under the covers.
Well, that's true. That's true. And that's what they tend to do, right? Like, I mean, it's completely getting missed on what's going on with Kaylee, and, you know, significant changes have happened, and she's been diagnosed with a brain tumor. And
a tumor now?
Yeah, on the midbrain of her, the back of her head, as well as... two on the front of her lobe as well.
Really?
And that was after, if you guys remember when we did the protesting out front of Sick Kids to get the MRI, and they refused to give it to us. Finally, the fight, you know, ended to the point that we got the MRI finally.
Yeah.
About 2.5-3 weeks ago, and
those are the results.
Diagnosed her with brain tumors. So.
And you had to fight even for an MRI.
You got it. Yeah. So. Really, what, you know, not much to say in respect to, you know, the hospital, and we still believe that their ultimate goal is to, you know, have Kaylee pass on, and then they don't have to deal with, you know, us anymore, as they say, and, you know, that's about it. I mean,
the CEO, Mary Jo Haddad, has been quoted in another interview as saying, "We're not in the business of killing children at SickKids."
And I've heard that comment before. We're not in the business of killing children. You know, what's funny though, people forget about the Susan Nellis case back in the 80s when all those babies died of mysterious reasons. Yet, you know, she was acquitted, and nobody was ever charged with the deaths of those children. Yet something happened somewhere and for some reason.
Yeah.
So they can say they're not in the business of it. I don't believe that they strictly make money by killing people.
Oh, I see, yeah. But
there's
maybe
there's no business for it. But what I do believe is that there is protocol to terminate those that have a genetic abnormality that can't be changed or can't be treated. I think that they think of those children as, deficiencies, damaged goods. And that's a terrible way to, you know, think about a hospital of that nature doing something like that. But everything that they have done has supported what they're about, you know.
Well, Annie Farlow's death is
Annie Farlow is a clear case about termination by euthanizing the baby. An attempt in our circumstance, obviously, is a life support discontinuation twice, not only once, but twice, and the Demerol and the morphine being injected in her, and then all of a sudden...
And fentanyl, you think?
Yeah.
Fortunately, it's not completely clear yet, because the hospital is still refusing to release the forms, which they admit they have, that show the drugs administered to Annie Farlow.
Oh, right, but the thing is, I think that makes it the clearest case.
I think so, too.
The fact that they hide it should cause the public a grave concern. I mean, if there was nothing amiss with it, then they should have, come out and exposed themselves. Same deal as I'm waiting for the big ball-less clowns at Sick Kids Hospital to come out and sue me for all of the statements I've said about them hurting children and trying to hurt our child.
The last thing they want is to give you a stage by suing you.
Of course they don't want to. Because they know, one, we're true, what they're doing, and two, they wouldn't have a leg to stand on in the courtroom. It would expose them. You know, as I've said and as my wife has said, on several occasions, we're not crazy parents. We've never been certified by any psychologist anywhere. CS have been involved and cleared any issues of concerns.
It's not about you. I think anybody who thinks clearly can see that.
But I think this has been made to be about us. With how the media has perceived the circumstances.
Well, this is an ad hominem attack, which is when you are afraid of the issue, change the issue to the person, and then attack the person instead of discussing the issue.
Well,
and it's as old as people.
I've met a number of people over the year, and they have said to me, "Oh, I recognize you," and it's kind of like, okay, yes, you recognize me. I'll tell you how. And when I tell them the story about what happened and so forth, they all say to me, "That's not what the media made you look like. That's not this, not that."
Really?
And I'm glad to hear it from the horse's mouth.
Yeah.
And because the only way for individuals to make change is, one, if they have a clear, record or whatever else you would say. There's no muddy waters that would suggest that the person has an ulterior motive or anything else. And that's why the media has to damage me to the level that they have to, because any changes I want to make, I'm looked at as a whack job. Oh, they don't need to be made. That hospital's great. They're doing just the most wonderful thing for these children. Let's just keep giving them money and setting up lemonade stands and building new cancer centers for them. Let's do everything. And the real reality is we're going to fix the mystique of what the hospital is, but we're never going to actually truly save the children. And that's the big issue that's going on right now. So
that's true. It's quite true. Sam Sansalone suggested that since Mary Jo Haddad was aware of the issues at Sick Children's 3 years before Annie Farlow died, obviously nothing of substance had been done about them, or Annie Farlow would have still been alive after her visit to Sick Kids.
Right.
And he noted that she'd been awarded the Order of Canada, and that if it were clear that she was aware of the killing of children at Sick Kids and had denied it, in a provable way that she could be stripped of her Order of Canada.
Yes, no, and I understand that.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of them have to fight for that, and you're fighting such a big, beastly institution against, you know, the only power that we have is our voice, and the power for Kaylee is our voice. And at the end of the day, we will scream as loud as people will, you know, have their ears open to listen to it, and without doing that, it's going to result in no changes being made and this happening to another family. One day it may change, and we've got to scream as loud as we can from the highest mountains as possible. And you know, whether Kaylee passes on or Kaylee doesn't, will not change the fact of our voice and will not change the fact of what changes we believe need to be done.
Well, even the delay to the MRIs is a contributing factor if she does pass on.
Oh, of course.
It's unfortunate that that they've taken this approach. The Globe and Mail today, July 27th, came out with several pieces about a website of which many journalists and the public at large were substantially unaware, called WikiLeaks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a place where you can post material on servers in Sweden where the sources cannot be forced to be divulged.
Right.
And I think some excerpts from our interview and some excerpts from my interviews with Sam are going to end up on WikiLeaks, and I hope that Barb Farlow has some written material to put up on WikiLeaks, and that then maybe perhaps then the journalists will pick it up and run with it. Now, I know people don't like to hear this stuff, but if it was you or your father or mother, you might wish you'd listened to it and done something about it, wouldn't you?
You'd think that, you know, people would want the change, but you know what? We live in such a complacent society that nobody really believes and nobody really cares anymore. It's a sad day in our society when, you know, two women are trying to sue the RCMP and the federal government because they had to witness a decapitation and a cannibalism of a body involving that Greyhound situation.
Oh, yeah.
And the only thing I'll say to that is, you know, they didn't have to watch. Why? What do they deserve $3 million for? It's just we live in such a sick world when it's about money. And
I see.
It's never about the true humanity that needs to be dealt with. And you know, Kaylee is one of those, you know, unique stories that was made public of an existing situation in our healthcare system.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
So, I mean, I don't say that this is a rarity. I say that this is a rarity that it becomes public because we're so complacent. But there's not much you can do. They try to beat you down. They try to browbeat you. There's no question about that. But, you know, we stand up and fight for Kaylee, and every day that, you know, nurses and other specialists get involved, there's a clear sense of let's stand with this family and do what we can.
Okay.
So, you know, I do appreciate that support that we get from our existing community.
Oh, good.
Not the greater of the community, but certainly parts of the community.
It seems that part of the community educated about health care.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
All right.
I think it's opened people's eyes, too. And the problem is, once you start the ball rolling, it's hard to keep it rolling because people try to silence you in one way or another. And so, you know, at the end of the day, where an issue is something now, an hour from now, the issue could be different. A lot of smoke and mirrors that are thrown up.
That's true, too. Where are you going to get Kaylee's tumors treated?
At this point in time, we've been consulted by the chief neurologist for children in Toronto. Has said that it's inoperable. It's in the midbrain, the one of them, and the three in the front. The two in the front are not of real concern. But at this point in time, the midbrain one is definitely of concern. So,
and that's one doctor. You don't know this doctor's values. That's his or her opinion that it's inoperable.
Right.
Have you asked anyone else who has facts out there?
Not as of yet. I mean, at the end of the day, we yield to the specialists that are not necessarily sick kid specialists.
Yeah, we have to.
Yeah, we have to. There's no doubt. So,
but second opinion isn't a new idea.
No. And I, you know, obviously I'm quite learned with respect to the condition that Kaylee has, and also quite learned to the respect of what midbrain tumors are. It's in the back of the brain at the midbrain where the brainstem meets. That's where it is. And it's deep. So to go in there.
So it's above the brain stem.
Yeah, just above it, yeah.
Okay, so yeah. That's a mess.
It is a mess. Mm-hmm. And to do anything more about it is would only be more detrimental to Kaylee.
Yes.
And we understand that. Now, the one thing we don't understand is why they refuse to put a shunt in. This little girl's in pain almost every day. They don't have her on anti-seizure medication.
Still not, eh?
No, and her head circumference continues to grow at a rate that's abnormal to a child.
Oh.
And that's clear that there's a subcranial pressure. They won't.
Well, there are other people than sick kids to put in something like a shunt, but you can't get any of them to cooperate locally?
Nobody will cooperate now.
Oh, okay.
So it's a very, very difficult situation, to say the least. But,
the head of Not Dead Yet in Rochester, New York, is hydrocephalic, and he has a shunt.
Right.
Have you spoken with him, Stephen Drake?
No.
You should maybe email Stephen Drake. His site is Not Dead Yet.
Okay.
Yeah, he'd be very sensitive to the issue of a shunt.
Well, we'd be happy to hear from anybody in the public.
I don't know that you'd get him to volunteer, but if you approached him about the whole issue, I'm sure you'd get some kind of support.
Right. Okay.
Because it's up his alley personally as well as up his alley professionally.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
Well, was there anything else that you wanted to say?
No, I think that that's about it. That's an update on Kaylee, and that's an answer to how we feel about the circumstances and the continued actions of sick kids. I mean, there's not much more that can be said. I mean, you can go out and dig deep and maybe make them answer. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, there will be brief quotes from the interviews, and by now there are quite a few interviews.
Okay.
So there will be brief quotes from all of them on WikiLeaks, starting next week with the most recent interview with Sam. And if there's anything that stands out in this brief interview with you, perhaps it too. And then I will go back and search for corroborating statements in the previous interviews, like Barbara Farlow.
That sounds good.
Okay.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jason.
And take care to your listeners as well.
All right, thanks. Bye. Eddie Bo and Hard Times. Thank you. And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These aren't the full stories that we read to you, but condensations of the stories that we find in the newspapers that we name in the following broadcast. Toronto Star: sit-in ends with activists' arrest. Liberal offices invaded by anti-poverty group. And this is a Canadian Press. Several anti-poverty activists have been rounded up by police after briefly occupying offices of Ontario's Liberal Party in downtown Toronto. An organizer for the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty says about 10 people were detained by the police. AJ Withers says she was told the 10 were being charged with trespassing after they were removed from the second floor offices of Yonge and Bloor Streets. There was no immediate word from police about the charges. The action came during a rally against the elimination of a special diet allowance for welfare recipients, which drew about 200 to 300 people to the area. We have subsequent news that 9 of these people were released. The activists say the Liberal government's decision to scrap the allowance and replace it with a new program will lead to more hunger, poor health, and homelessness in the province. Premier Dalton McGuinty has said the cost of the program jumped from $6 million to $250 million a year and must be reined in. Dalton McGuinty must be reined in. Toronto Star again, more charges loom in toddler tragedy. An insight into Alberta daycare facilities. Medicine Hat, Alberta. Police say charges against the caregiver could be upgraded depending on results from an autopsy on a toddler who was allegedly assaulted in a southern Alberta day home. The 18-month-old girl died in hospital from head injuries. She had been taken by air ambulance from Medicine Hat to Alberta Children's Hospital in Calgary. A 23-year-old woman who was taking care of her at the private residence has been charged with aggravated assault and failing to provide the necessities of life. Medicine Hat police anticipate those charges might be adjusted once the autopsy is complete, although Staff Sergeant Brent Sekondiak says it will take a while to fully investigate what happened. He said it's unknown how the girl sustained the fatal injuries and it's difficult to pull together the case because of trauma to her head. Yvonne Fritz, the province's Children and Youth Services Minister, said the facility is licensed by the provincial government. She said the day home is a satellite of the Children's Corner Day Home Agency in Medicine Hat, which has had a contract with the Family Services Authority for 16 years. Fritz said the province will conduct an investigation and said the death was a very unusual circumstance and there are few problems in Alberta's 2,800 provincially accredited care homes. Well, if it's your problem, Fritz, it's a big one. Campaign help urge for disabled candidates. Mary Gutsy, Canadian Press again from the Toronto Star. A new report says political candidates with disabilities should not have to include accessibility costs in their campaign spending limits. At least one former politician, however, says more is needed to remove barriers. The Ontario Human Rights Commission said costs such as sign language interpreting and braille translation should be exempted. While changes to election laws have improved accessibility for voters, accommodation is lagging behind for candidates, said Commissioner Barbara Hall. I think we're seeing progress, said Hall, explaining that all polling stations must be held in accessible locations, but there's still more to be done to make it really possible for people with disabilities to run as candidates. Canada's Minister of State, Stephen Fletcher, who uses a wheelchair, said he could overcome barriers by using his own accessible car and bringing a portable ramp and other equipment while campaigning. At a municipal level or provincial level, I think the barriers to campaigning may be systemic to society, depending on where you live. The report comes just months ahead of October's province-wide municipal elections. The Commission will be watching the municipal elections and the 2011 provincial campaign closely, Hall said. Globe and Mail, Wednesday, July 21st. Pharmaceuticals from Bloomberg. Glaxo said to have paid $1 billion over Paxil suits. GlaxoSmithKline PLC has agreed to pay more than $1 billion U.S. to resolve more than 800 cases alleging its Paxil antidepressant caused birth defects in some users' children, according to people familiar with the settlements. The accords, which provide an average payout of more than $1.2 million to families of affected children, leave more than 100 birth defect cases pending, the people said. Officials of Glaxo, the UK's biggest drug maker, said July 15th they set aside $2.4 billion to resolve litigation over Paxil and its Avandia diabetes drug. The birth defect settlements bring to more than $2 billion the amount Glaxo has agreed to pay to resolve a variety of Paxil-related suits, the people said. From the Globe and Mail, Harper's snub assailed. One of the world's most prominent AIDS scientists is lashing out at Stephen Harper, saying the Canadian Prime Minister snubbed organizers of a major international conference because he is, quote, afraid, unquote, to show his face after his lack of leadership on health at the recent G8 summit. My country's Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, was invited to be a plenary speaker, and he refused. Julio Montaner, president of the International AIDS Society, told reporters Sunday at a press conference before the opening of the International AIDS Conference in Vienna. He's not here because he's afraid to confront the deficit the G8 left on the table, he said. Dr. Montaner was fuming because the group of eight nations under Mr. Harper's chairmanship did not discuss HIV/AIDS at its recent Toronto summit, and member countries, including Canada, have reduced their contributions to fighting the epidemic. I cannot hide my profound disappointment and deep frustration with the recently concluded G8 G20 meetings in Canada, he said. By failing to commit and fund treatment for all people with HIV/AIDS, Dr. Montaner said, the G8 has quite simply failed us. Mr. Harper infamously refused to attend the International AIDS Conference when it was held in Toronto in 2006, drawing the worldwide ire of AIDS activists. The Prime Minister has also had an ongoing spat with Dr. Montaner over the funding of InSight, a safe injection site in Vancouver. Dr. Montaner spearheaded the project as a way of reducing the spread of HIV/AIDS among injection drug users, while Ottawa wants to shut the project down. Federal Health Minister Leona Aglukkaq is attending the International AIDS Conference, but she is not scheduled to speak. Globe and Mail, Monday, July 19th. Study bolsters treatment as prevention campaign. BC research finds dramatic drop in new diagnoses when people are treated earlier and more broadly. By Andre Picard and Sigdem Iltan. The importance of treating people with HIV with antiretroviral drugs is greater than ever, British Columbia researchers say after they discovered a significant drop in new HIV diagnoses when more people were treated with the drug cocktails. The notion that treating HIV can reduce the chances of the disease spreading and therefore is also an effective means of prevention is a true game changer, Dr. Julio Montaner, lead researcher of the study and director of the BC Centre for Excellence in HIV/AIDS, said at the International AIDS Society conference in Vienna. The research is one of several studies that have encouraged the United Nations Programme on HIV/AIDS to change its approach to the epidemic and view treatment as a prevention tool. Researchers observed a 3% decrease in HIV diagnoses in BC for every 100 patients who use the treatment, called highly active antiretroviral therapy. As use of the therapy in BC increased 547% between 1996 and 2009, the number of new HIV diagnoses fell 52%, according to the study. Antiretroviral drugs, which can slow the progression of HIV/AIDS symptoms, decrease viral loads in plasma and other biological fluids, the study said. The findings dramatically enhance the return on investment for the therapy and bolster the campaign for treating people earlier and more broadly because they will be less likely to infect others, Dr. Montaner said. The study was published in the medical journal The Lancet. Globe and Mail, Healthcare by Carly Weeks. Thousands of children facing unacceptable wait times for surgery. Thousands of Canadian children experience unacceptably long wait times for surgical procedures, which put them at risk of developing lifelong health problems, a new report says. In 2009, more than 17,000 children were not treated within timeframes deemed acceptable by physicians, an annual report released by the Wait Time Alliance shows. The report exposes new depths to Canada's chronic deficiencies in managing wait times for common health procedures. The scope of problems outlined in the new report comes after several regions of Canada missed a March 31st deadline to establish guaranteed maximum wait times for at least one area of care. Alberta and the three territories either failed to implement a guarantee or didn't release enough information to indicate one was in place. Guarantees set by other provinces were often weak and in some cases set excessively long waiting periods as guaranteed times for treatment, according to the Wait Time Alliance. The original five areas of care to be studied included hip and knee replacements, cataract surgery, radiation oncology, cardiac care, and diagnostic scans. The Alliance has also begun to track wait times for other areas such as chronic pain, gastroenterology, nuclear medicine, plastic surgery, and obstetrics and gynecology. This year marks the first time the Alliance has included a comprehensive evaluation of wait times for pediatric procedures. Although 73% of children receive surgery within the benchmark established by the Canadian Pediatric Surgical Wait Times Project, which was designed to measure wait times for children, more than 17,000 children had to wait for excessive lengths of time for treatment. The biggest problems occurred in dentistry, plastic surgery, and ophthalmology, said Dr. Lauren Bellin, co-chair of the Wait Time Alliance. In the Wait Times Marathon, we're still on the first mile. There's scant information available on wait times for other areas of medicine outside the five priority areas, making it difficult to assess how long the patients are being forced to wait or what the scope of problems may be, the report said. The report also singled out Alberta and Newfoundland and Labrador for failing to update their wait times data in more than 6 months. Globe and Mail, Tuesday, July 20th. Burden of arthritis gets heavier for Canadians. One in five Canadians, the bulk of them under age 65, are expected to develop arthritis by 2031, making it one of the most significant chronic health burdens facing the country. Those numbers are contained in a report released by the Public Health Agency of Canada, which provides an important snapshot of the disease's prevalence and impact on sufferers as well as on the healthcare system, an estimated $7.7 billion in 2008. What it does not examine, say members of the arthritis community, is how little is known about causes or risk factors and how far Canada is from developing a comprehensive strategy to tackle chronic pain. More than 4 million Canadians age 15 and over reported having some form of arthritis in 2007 to 2008, said the agency's second ever national report, which is based on data collected by such organizations as Statistics Canada, the Public Health Agency of Canada, and the Canadian Institute for Health Information. Of those people, nearly 60% were below age 65 and nearly two-thirds were women, the report found. One of the best ways to help people with arthritis is to improve diagnosis rates across Canada, said Lynn Moore, Director of Public Affairs at the Arthritis Society, a not-for-profit advocacy group based in Toronto. Early diagnosis and treatment of arthritis is known to help prevent joint disfigurement or other serious health problems, but many sufferers aren't diagnosed until the disorder has already taken a toll, she said. Experts say family physicians often lack the training necessary to make a proper diagnosis. Globe and Mail, Tralee Pierce, autism signs can be detected in early speech. To a trained ear, a child's early speech patterns can hint at autism, but as a screening method, detecting speech and voice problems can be difficult and is not widely used. Now, new research suggests that an automated system may one day take some of the guesswork out of detecting the neural disorder in young children by recognizing deviations from the norm in voice recordings. Lead author Kimbro Aller and his colleagues analyzed nearly 1,500 full-day soundtracks from 232 children ages 10 months to 4 years. The children wore recording devices snapped onto their clothing. About half of the children were considered to be typically developing. Of the remaining children, about 50 had been diagnosed as language delayed and about 75 had been diagnosed with autism. And this is out of 232, recall. There's a robust difference between the groups, says Dr. Aller. The study was published in the U.S. Journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The automated system separated the sounds made by the children from background noise and then classified each utterance according to common characteristics of vocal development, including creating syllables, articulation, and pitch. The program was able to correctly classify the typically developing children by their age. It was then able to differentiate the autistic kids from the typically developing kids 86% of the time, says Dr. Aller, a professor at the School of Audiology and Speech Language Pathology at the University of Memphis. When looking at these two groups, plus the language-delayed kids, the software worked 79% of the time in tracking autism, mostly because autistic children and children with language delay can have similar overlapping deficits. The deficits in the speech and voice patterns of the autistic children are particularly difficult to quantify because they can appear in various combinations and in varying degrees over time. Other measures are likely to remain stronger indicators than speech and screening for autism, Dr. Aller says. One such measure is known as joint attention, in which infants point at objects, then look to a parent or caregiver to, in effect, share the thought. This usually happens around 1 year of age, but autistic children don't do it or do much less of it than typically developing children. His research proves that speech and voice do have a place in the diagnosis of autism, he says. People have always claimed that vocalization is different with autistic children. There is now a way to detect it, and it can be done totally objectively. And we have a load of good news for this week's newscast. Technology in the Globe and Mail by Ian Marlowe and Omar El Akkad. The Government of Canada should ensure all Canadians have access to basic and essential digital services such as broadband internet, a Senate committee has concluded. The government should use proceeds from the sale of wireless licenses to pay for broadband internet in rural and remote locations across the country. There's a disproportion between what the government collects and what they spend on broadband, said Dennis Dawson, chair of the committee. There has to be a better way. Michael Hennessy, TELUS Corp's senior vice president for government and regulatory affairs, has long argued that the government lacks the funds to properly roll broadband across the whole country. The senators originally set out in March 2009 to study Canada's wireless sector, but broadened its mandate to the broader focus on a digital society. The committee's main recommendation focuses on the breadth rather than top-end quality of internet access in Canada. States the report, the government should determine the broadband speed required to access basic digital services, such as health, education, or other online services, whether provided by the public or private sector. Canada is a vast, sparsely populated country with extremes in climate and terrain, but Canada's geography is a challenge, not an excuse. And this from last month's Globe and Mail, healing alongside a Manitoba lake, residential school survivors heal their own way, by Martin Zillig in the Weaver Lake Healing Camp. Keith Behrens recalled being beaten at a residential day school on his Manitoba reserve. They hit us with yardsticks across the back or made us kneel all day, said the soft-spoken Mr. Behrens. Or they made you stand with outstretched arms with books in your hands. An Aboriginal elder from Behrens River, Manitoba, Mr. Behrens is one of the 40 First Nations men and women affected by residential school experiences who are spending the week at a remote lake 280 kilometers northeast of Winnipeg. Just as thousands of people head into downtown Winnipeg to attend the first national hearing of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission on residential schools, the smaller group of Ojibwe elders from four Manitoba First Nations came by boat and float plane to a place deep in the boreal forest to share stories, pray, drum, sing, and reconnect with traditional practices lost during the residential school period. The Weaver Lake Healing Camp is a very real example of how we can heal our communities on the land, said Poplar River's Sophia Rabliauskas, spokesperson for the Pimachioan Aki Corporation, the group leading the efforts to have the area designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Seed money for the camp came from residential school survivors funding through the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, Mrs. Rabliauskas said, but this may be the camp's last year, she said, because it is quickly running out of funds. It would help us if more people came out to these types of places, and then they'll know what it's all about. There's a reason. It's for us to learn from Mother Earth. And from the Star, Laurie Monsebraten, social justice reporter, hope found in escaping poverty tract. Anti-poverty activist Mike Creek lost it all in 1993 when he was diagnosed with cancer. He was just 37. As he would later tell a packed Queen's Park forum, it wasn't the cancer or the depression that broke his spirit. It was the poverty. With no workplace disability benefits, he clung to employment insurance while enduring 9 months of chemotherapy, 2 surgeries, blood clots, seizures, and gaping skin wounds that wouldn't heal. When his EI ran out, he washed up on welfare. Within a year, he'd lost his downtown Toronto apartment, overstayed his welcome with friends, and was sleeping in homeless shelters. Eventually ended up in a subsidized apartment in a gloomy Regent Park high-rise where a man was slain the weekend he moved in. He was frightened, depressed, and alone. I was very sick. Basically, I was just waiting to die. But he lived. This past spring, Creek, an outspoken champion of the poor and advocate for welfare reform, marked his own escape from poverty. In late May, he signed the mortgage for his new home in Regent Park's first condominium complex at 1 Cole Street near the corner of Dundas and Parliament Streets. He may be a medical miracle. Creek's non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is in remission, but he believes his flight from poverty is no fluke. The 292-unit complex in Phase 1 of the city's 15-year Regent Park revitalization plan is just blocks away from the decrepit high-rise where he lived for a decade. When I was able to move, I didn't want to leave the community, he says. I think it's important to stay, to show others it's possible. During 12 years on welfare and Ontario Disability Support Plan, Creek lived on about $666 a month. With no money to go out with friends or entertain at home, he became a recluse. I felt deserted. Buried in a system that doesn't work for the people or the social workers who run it, he said. In early 2007, Creek saw a poster in his doctor's office inviting people with a history of homelessness to participate in a new advocacy program. The 12-week program, Voices from the Street, provided a TTC pass, meals, and a weekly honorarium of $60. Creek signed up and soon learned he was not alone. And he began to understand how government programs for the poor become a trap. When the program coordinator's position became available in early 2008, Creek applied, he got the job, and soon was earning $40,000 plus benefits. As a leader in the 25 and 5 Network for Poverty Reduction, Creek helped to push Ontario into adopting a goal of reducing child poverty in the province by 5% within 5 years. When the first Regent Park condos went on the market in February 2009, Creek was the fourth in line. He saved $1,000 a month for almost a year for the $11,000 down payment on his $200,000 600-square-foot unit. When I first moved in, I cried for a week, he confesses, still barely able to believe how far he has come. It was very emotional for me. It still is. I never dreamed of home ownership, let alone a job and a place in society, he says. I have been so fortunate to have been given choices again. It is those choices and opportunities that I want for all citizens. Hope is not just a four-letter word, he says. It is a dream that can come true. Disrespect pauses for a moment for Charles Brown's Traveling Blues.
So lonesome, I'm in a traveling mood. Oh, I'm so lonesome, I'm in a traveling mood. Going to California, where I can lose my blues. Sometimes I feel like walking, I have no walking shoes. I feel like walking, I have no walking shoes. I'm gonna hop me a freight to California. I've got the traveling blues. To San Francisco, gonna make it my home. Well, nobody knows my troubles but my baby and me.
And from the Toronto Star, family pins hope on surgery, Lisa Arrowsmith in the Canadian Press. 2-year-old Alberta boy undergoes operation in New York to correct rare facial deformity. The mother of an Alberta toddler with a rare facial deformity is hoping that a surgeon in New York City can repair more than just her son's swollen face. Protecting the 2-year-old boy's loving, sensitive heart is really at the core of why Nicole Champagne hopes that one day her son, Maddox, looks like every other child. The family was back at a hospital in the United States Monday as Maddox received a second operation to repair a huge swelling on his left cheek and mouth. In May, Dr. Milton Wehner, co-director of the Vascular Birthmark Institute of New York at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital Center, removed a large growth that had closed the boy's left eye. Maddox's malformation, called lymphatic cystic hygroma, caused large tumors to form on the left side of his face. But it's the invisible scratches that are threatening to emerge on her little boy's self-esteem that really hurt Champagne, 29. There were lots of children who would stare at him, lots of people actually that would stare at him, she said, as she paced the floor in a hospital waiting room during her son's surgery. When Mike and I took him out to the park, there were some kids who would start crying and would run away from him. He was starting to notice and wondering why everybody was looking at him differently, she said. He has such a great spirit, and he's so strong and loving and charismatic. I just don't want anything to ever damage him. Damage his soul, Champagne said. The surgery was expected to remove the growth, which has been preventing the toddler from learning to speak. With some help from a speech therapist, Champagne was hopeful her son would soon be able to start forming words. I'm just hoping that his face will be returned to normal so he can look like every other kid, she said. The two operations were expected to cost $100,000. Donations from across Canada, the United States, and Europe have poured in, and she said their latest estimate was that roughly $250,000 had been raised. Any money left over will likely be donated to Dr. Wehner's foundation that helps pay for such surgeries for families who can't afford it, she said. Toronto Star, Amy Dempsey, staff reporter. New heart, now new life. On the evening of January 7th, Jennifer Monteith decided to celebrate being alive. I decided to make myself a fabulous dinner, she says. I was at home and I felt like pork chops and mashed potatoes and green beans, and I'd been dying for a glass of wine. Monteith had spent more than a year and a half with a mechanical heart, a device attached to her heart's left ventricle that is powered by a battery pack she carried around in a shoulder bag. For most people who get the mechanical heart, the LVAD, or left ventricle assist device, is a bridge to a heart transplant. Few need them for longer than 6 months because a donor heart is usually found by then, but Monteith was in a difficult situation. Doctors had warned her that 90% of all potential donor hearts wouldn't work because her unusually high number of antibodies would cause her body to reject most of them. I'd just about given up and I'd settled for the fact that I'd have an LVAD and it was working good, she says. In her Bloor West Village home last January, Monteith prepared for what she calls a fancy night. She set the table, cranked the jazz, and turned on her fireplace. Then she got an unexpected call. "We have a heart for you, Jennifer." Monteith smiles as she relays memories of her three-year heart journey, but then she pauses as tears spill down her cheeks. "This is taking me back," she says, mopping her face with a cloth. She chuckles, shakes her head, and continues. Monteith, 57, doesn't know for sure what weakened her heart, but 2 years ago she was diagnosed with advanced heart failure with sudden death, a looming threat. Her doctors say she would have died without the LVAD. Monteith was one of the lucky ones, as just 90 patients have received a mechanical heart from the Peter Munk Cardiac Center since 2001. The devices cost about $100,000 and are funded by private hospital donors and the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care. Dr. Terence Yao, the surgeon who performed Monteith's transplant in January, says only a few mechanical heart users in the country had one as long as Monteith. "We never really thought that we'd get her a heart," he says. "But then, despite incredible odds, they found a match." It is possible to live permanently with an LVAD, but not easy. Monteith had to have a friend or relative with her at all times in case of an emergency and recharge her battery pack every 6 to 8 hours. The transplant gave Monteith her freedom back. "I'm home by myself without doctors and machines," she says. "I'm able to be on my own." "Can you imagine getting a new heart?" she says. "Somebody else giving you a heart and you are able to go out and have a second chance at life and carry on your dream." She laughs, wipes her face again and shakes her head. "It's just such a magical feeling. I look forward to my every day." And that's all the news for Disrespect this week. We invite you back next week. There will be more. Lafayette Leak and the Swiss Boogie. Thank you. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.